On that question, there are 56 voting aye, 2 voting nay, 0 voting present. House Bill 109, having received the required constitutional majority, is declared passed.
We almost have a budget, and maybe even on time. That's the bipartisan Senate vote yesterday. Senate President John Cullerton joins us, along with analysis from IPR's Brian Mackey and WBEZ's Tony Arnold. Plus, when it comes to infant and maternal mortality, we would expect that as medical advances improve, so should statistics. But the racial disparity between black and white mortality rates is larger than it was in 1850 during slavery. Why being black in America isn't good for your health, especially when it comes to having babies. And the first ever Pride Festival is taking place in Southern Illinois this weekend. We'll speak with one of the organizers. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. First, the news.
Did I hear you say this is the first time you voted for a budget?
It's the first time I voted yes for a budget as a Republican. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that says a lot. It may not seem like a big deal to people back home, but here, it's a big deal.
Does it feel like this is the way it's supposed to go?
Of course. This is the absolutely, this is the way it's supposed to go.
I just know what it's been like for these last couple of years, and especially exactly where we were last year. I'm finding myself sitting here smiling because all day long I've been telling people I feel unsettled. Like, I don't know if there's another shoe that's about to drop.
I think everyone who knows me knows this isn't a budget that I would draft by myself. But it is a budget given the reality of the makeup of the General Assembly. It is a budget given the reality and the philosophy of our governor that I believe we can all work with.
The best message we could send to the taxpayers of Illinois is not that we got 30 yes votes, or 36 or 39 yes votes, but that we got 50 yes votes, or 58 yes votes.
On that question, there are 56 voting aye, 2 voting nay, 0 voting present. House Bill 109, having received the required constitutional majority, is declared passed.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's the sounds of the Illinois Senate yesterday. Senators Karen McConaughey, Toy Hutchinson, Bill Brady, and Jim Overweis. The bipartisan budget proposal won the Senate by a vote of 56-2, as you just heard, and now goes to the Illinois House on the actual deadline for when the State House is supposed to pass a budget. Thanks to 21st producer Alan Montesilio for producing that audio for us. You also heard the intrepid voice of Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey, who provided much of that audio for us, is on the line now from Springfield in the state capitol, along with WBEZ's Tony Arnold. Brian, Tony, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here, guys.
Hello, Nyla.
Hi, Nyla.
Let's start with first of all, just your response. This is the way that it's supposed to go. Senators, lawmakers are supposed to get together. Today is the deadline for when a budget should be implemented. How rare occurrence has this been over the past couple of years?
Past couple of years, it's a unicorn. If you go back further than that in state history, I mean, you have to kind of go into the record books now to find where it was this sort of bipartisan kumbaya process. And that's perhaps overstating it. But yeah, this is definitely unique, certainly during the Rauner administration. Remember, there weren't budgets for a couple of years. But even during the Quinn administration, Republicans were largely shut out of the budget making process.
Tony, how did we get to this point? This is such a difference from a year ago.
Well, it is. And what's different is that the strategy has been different in how to put together this budget. This was done mostly by legislative leaders in private meetings that weren't the people that have been at the crux of, you know, the impasse. It wasn't Governor Bruce Rauner and House Speaker Michael Madigan together in a room, because those two would just hate each other, and that was what drove a lot of the impasse. This has been much more driven by individual members getting together and in closed door meetings, hashing out how much money is going to be coming in and where should that money be going. Part of the reason I think that this is going at all past the Senate last night is because Republicans who voted against the budget that ended up ending the impasse because it included a tax increase agreed, those Republicans who opposed it agreed to spend the money from that tax increase that they opposed, kind of on the condition that Democrats wouldn't overspend or that the budget would be balanced, is another way to say it. And that's partially why you're seeing this cooperation, is that that agreement seems to be where we're at right now as we await to see what the House does today.
That's WBEZ political reporter Tony Arnold. IPR's Brian Mackey is with us, both of them from the press house inside the state capitol. Later in the hour, we are going to be speaking with Senate President John Cullerton, getting his reaction to all of this. Brian, to Tony's point, this is a balanced budget that's been presented.
I mean, that's the argument. You know, there's actually literally several different ways to determine whether a budget is balanced, and you really can't technically know until the end of the budget year. But as it's presented, it certainly meets the constitutional requirement that the money they estimate will be available to spend this year is greater than what's actually going to be spent by, I think, what is it, $20 million or some very small decimal point. But yes, the way it's being presented, it's a balanced budget. Most members of, at least in the Senate, legislators on both sides of the aisle are saying it's a balanced budget. There was a report from the Sun-Times that even the governor has apparently said to the Senate Republicans that he sort of blessed their read of it being a balanced budget. But we have yet to hear that from the governor himself. And that's one of the big questions here. Will he sign it or will he try and campaign against it? I mean, this was one of his big criteria, as Tony said. Republicans wanted to see a balanced budget. And this does appear to be that. It's a pretty boring budget, right? This is a fairly status quo.
No, I think everybody wants boring after the past couple of years,
exactly,
Brian. So we'll
right.
get,
but
let's
this
get
is
into
like boring
some
is good.
I do want to get into some of those details in a minute of the actual budget. But Tony, let me just ask, to Brian's point, does whether or not Governor Rauner supports the budget matter when we've looked at how strong the vote was in the Senate of 56-2? Of course, we don't know what the House yet vote will be. Does Governor Rauner's support matter?
It still matters because this, if he were to veto it, it'd still have to go back and things change. I should say that it's Bill Brady, the Senate Republican leader, indicated that the governor does support this, but we haven't heard it directly, you know, from Rauner himself. And even last night, his administration was quiet on this. So we're still waiting to see. But it's at the end of the day, it's still the governor. His opinion does matter. He's got to sign it. And the fact that he's still holding his cards close to the chest is, you know, I'm not ruling anything out yet until this is a done deal and signed.
Brian Mackey, let's get into some of the details of this budget when we're talking about education, higher education, local government. Let's start with just K-12 education. This budget has a $350 million increase. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of different funds. So, yeah, I mean, it does fund the $350 million increase that's part of this new evidence-based funding model, the way Illinois did a major change to the way it funds schools last year that is supposed to direct more of the state money, the state share of school funding, to the school districts that need it most. So the ones that have lower property wealth, they don't have big shopping malls and factories and things like that to help the, you know, fund schools through property taxes. Overall, I think there's something like a $400 million increase to schools, but
I don't know how much they mean to people.
It's basically a 5% increase to education, but this is sort of just sticking with the plan as it was laid out as part of this big compromise last year.
A 2% increase as well for higher education. That 5% increase is for K-12. That translates into, is that about a $25 million increase for public universities and community colleges, Brian? What does that funding look like over the past couple of years?
Yeah, it's the funding in the past few years has been really hurt for public universities. And full disclosure, you and I are employees of a public university, the University of Illinois, which holds the licenses to our radio stations. But that university has been among the least affected, but particularly the directional universities, Southern, Western, Eastern, really took a hit during the budget impasse. They're more reliant on the state as opposed to tuition and federal grants and other things that, that fund universities. They're more reliant on the state, and so the budget impasse really did damage, and they've seen enrollment drop. Even the U of I has reported that the not an enrollment decline, but top-tier professors are being poached by other universities. Apparently, a Texas school had a specific fund that was meant to help target Illinois professors to lure them out of state. So the universities are hoping to fight this a little bit. There's a pilot program, a new grant, $25 million that it would match. If universities match it, it's supposed to help lure Illinois undergraduate students to stay at Illinois universities.
SIU President Randy Dunn said that the roughly 2% hike that's included in the budget plan is going to give them some breathing room, to your point, Brian. He said, quote, "We're really heartened by that, given what we've been through over the past few years with the state budget impasse. I think this speaks well to the importance that the legislature sees for what higher education does for the state." That's SIU President Randy Dunn. Tony, what about the other elephant in the room, which is pensions and pension costs? Did we see any movement on that? Is there any discussion of that in the budget?
As far as I know, not much. Brian might know a little bit more. Admittedly, I was looking at some other different types of the spending parts of it, and so I'll defer to Brian on that.
Yeah, so I mean, there's none of the big sort of changes that we saw attempted in the past. Nothing that seems, you never know, but it doesn't seem like there's anything that's quite of questionable constitutionality being tried this year. There is a plan to attempt to get some people to sort of buy out. This would be a voluntary plan, so there seemingly would be no constitutional problems with that. The idea is people could trade some of their future benefit in order for a cash payout now in an attempt to sort of bend that long-term cost curve. But this is pretty small stuff at the margins. One of the big proposals that was being considered related to pensions this year, Governor Rauner had called for having local school districts as well as state universities pick up the employer share of pension costs. That's something that's currently paid by the state to the tune of hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars a year. And the governor wanted to shift those costs out. That is not part of this deal, though.
Tony, what else stands out to you with this budget?
One thing I would reiterate is how what's coming into the state, which is that the tax rate did not change. This is where, you know, taxes go up or down is in budgets, and they kept things flat. The income tax rate is staying the same. I don't think that that could be kind of overstated, considering that we're in a campaign year and what you're paying out of your income to the state is one of the central issues to this campaign, whether it's Governor Rauner's position that Illinois should remain a flat tax so that you, me, and Brian, and everyone else pays the same percent of out of our paycheck. And even Rauner said that he could lower that, or J.B. Pritzker's point of view that the state should move to a graduated income tax rate. So that's one thing.
Right, that requires a constitutional amendment change.
It does. And then the other thing that two other spending points that stand out to me. One is that there's a considerable amount of money for the Obama Presidential Center, which would go in Chicago. And then the other thing, which is something that has been at the center point of a WBZ investigation now for several months, which is the Quincy Veterans Home. And there is about $53 million in this budget to rehab a nursing home down the street from the Veterans Home to move residents there. On a potentially interim basis, if not long-term basis, while they reconstruct and build a brand new facility there. So $53 million gets that started. It doesn't finish it, considering that this would be several years long project. It's a far cry from what Governor Rauner proposed or wants, which is almost $200 million more than that. But I've been told that there's time to get the rest of that money in the future. This just gets the ball rolling on that.
Right. And that's, of course, we will tweet out all of the reporting that WBEZ has been doing about their investigations into the Quincy Veterans Home. Tony Arnold doing much of that. Let me ask, what's next here? What's next for the House? What's the timing of the House vote today?
That remains to be determined, but as far as we know, things still seem to be on track. The Republicans were meeting behind closed doors this morning, presumably to talk about this. We saw two Senate Republicans not vote for this yesterday, but they tend to be a fairly unified caucus. There, you know, could be some more voices of dissent, I would expect, frankly, in the House Republican caucus. But, you know, if things hold together, then the budget could be sent to the governor, or at least on its way to the governor by the end of the day.
We just have about a minute left. I just wanted to ask you about some news that broke just as we went on the air, which is President Trump saying to reporters aboard Air Force One that he's strongly considering a commutation of the rest of ex-former Governor Rod Blagojevich's sentence. I don't know. I know this news just broke as we just went to air. I don't know if you guys have heard anything in the State House, any conversation about this yet, or just reaction to that from either of you?
No, frankly, we've been talking to you the whole time.
Yeah, we got the alert just as it came down. But I would say that his wife, Patty Blagojevich, has been on a public publicity campaign just to get the attention of the president.
Going on Fox News.
There was the Wall Street Journal editorial earlier this week.
Yeah, for exactly this result. So although it's not done yet, apparently the president is just considering this commuting of Blagojevich's sentence. But this has been a strategy from the family of the Blagojeviches and their attorneys to get this done.
And we know the president is not a huge fan of the Justice Department right now.
So we will continue to follow that story as that develops today. You can stay tuned to this public radio station to hear more about, I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more coming out of Washington, about President Trump and former Governor Rod Blagojevich. I want to thank Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey and WBEZ's Tony Arnold for breaking down a lot of this budget today for us. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks.
Stay tuned. Coming up, we're going to be talking about infant mortality rates among Black Americans. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you think of women dying during childbirth, you probably think of scenes you've read about in history books or seen depicted in period dramas like Downton Abbey. But the reality is, this is very much still happening in this country and in this century, and it's mostly happening among African American women. And it's not just the mothers. Black infants are far more likely to die than their white counterparts, twice as likely. And the research tells us the disparity really does come down to the lived experience of race. The problem of infant and maternal mortality among African American women is so great, it's driving the entire U.S. rate for both up. In fact, the racial disparity of these mortality rates is larger than it was in 1850 during slavery. Joining me to talk about what we're understanding about this issue and what some public health advocates are trying to do about it are Janine Hill. She's the president of SOAR Strategies and also teaches at the School of Public Health at UIC. She's the former director of the Illinois Maternal and Child Health Coalition, now known as EverThrive. Dr. Richard David is also with us. He's a pediatrics professor also at UIC. Dr. David, Janine, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you.
Dr. David, let me start by asking, when we're talking about this racial disparity in terms of outcomes, I wanted to ask what we're seeing, both in terms of mothers who are dying during childbirth and Black infants not surviving their first year.
Well, the rates of maternal death and infant death are both extremely high. They're unconscionably high. The United States, for infant mortality, in one recent year I looked at, ranked about 30th in the world. So even though we spend more than any other country, our performance is terrible, ranking about 30th in the world. I'd like to add another dimension to this as well, because everything you said in your introduction was, I think, right on target, except that you said that the black rate was driving the overall poor performance of the United States. And a fact that is not talked about nearly as much is the fact that if you looked at the rate of infant mortality among whites in this country, it's also terrible. If you ranked white infants as a separate country, the same year that the United States ranked 30, white infants would have ranked 28. So even though it's not nearly as bad as the African-American outcomes, it's still terrible compared to other countries.
Yeah, certainly terrible given what we would see among a developed country. As you said, Dr. David, the amount of money that we're spending on health care and infant and mothers particularly. Janine, can I ask you what this issue looks like in Illinois?
Sure. Most of our birth statistics come from the Illinois Department of Public Health. And the last year for birth statistics, and in particular infant mortality, is 2014. And so what you see is we're at about 6.6 deaths per 1,000 live births, which is usually how infant mortality rates are portrayed. Illinois ranks basically 36th out of our 50 states in the District of Columbia. If you tease that out by race, however, if you look at the 30-year period between 1980 and 2010, what you see is the black-white ratio in infant mortality actually increasing during that time period. In 1980, you'll see it about 2.2 different, meaning 2.2 black babies die for every one white baby before its first birthday. And in 2010, we see that number increase to about 2.5. And nationally, it's typically between 2 and 3-fold different infant mortality rate between white and black infants.
And Dr. David, to Janine's point, when we're looking at the historical context of infant mortality, I would imagine on the whole, do we see that it's improving or that the disparity is getting bigger? What are we seeing?
Well, overall, if you look at the overall infant mortality rates over time for the United States or for just about any country, they've gotten better. But the rate of improvement is not the same everywhere, and it's worse in this country than other places. So that in 1950, the United States would have ranked about number 6 in the world behind Sweden and some other Scandinavian countries. And as I said before, we've dropped to 30th, not because our rates have gotten higher, but because the rest of the world has moved ahead and the United States has stagnated. The same kind of deterioration has occurred in the black-white gap. As Janine Hill just said a moment ago, it's widened in Illinois, and it's also widened for the entire United States. And it's also over a longer period of time. You can go all the way back to the 1950s, and the rate has gotten wider. So there's a direct correlation, a direct parallel between the deterioration internationally and the widening gap within the United States.
I mean, I think people who are listening to this would, especially for the first time, would find these numbers shocking. And Janine, I wonder, the next question they probably have is, why is this happening? And I wanted to ask, what are the reasons people initially thought was an explanation for this disparity?
Sure. So I think a lot of our research, you know, I would say up until probably the 1990s, focused on black women's greater exposure to risk factors. So either before or during the time of pregnancy. So thinking about risk factors linked to poverty and low socioeconomic status. So this might be things like educational level and insurance status, limited access to prenatal care. So care during pregnancy, health care during pregnancy, and then kind of going into pregnancy and remaining during pregnancy in a poor state of physical and mental health. So this might include things like being obese or being hypertensive or having high blood pressure during or before pregnancy or smoking. I think those are the reasons we try to explain these racial and ethnic disparities, but I don't, and they tell us part of the story, but definitely not, I think, the most compelling parts of the story.
Right. And Dr. David, you've done research on this as well. You've shown that this is not the case. The things that Janine is talking about are not the reasons why African-American women and babies are dying at a higher rate.
Right. I would completely endorse what Janine said. I think there was sort of a shift in the way we looked at this starting in the 1990s, whereas we had looked for, you know, whatever, what are the risk factors that can apply to any woman, and why is it that there are higher levels of these risk factors in Black women, and how much of the difference does that explain? And it does explain some of it, but there's something more going on here. There's a set of risk factors that apply to women because they are Black, and it has nothing to do with genetics. It has to do with being in a society that discriminates on the basis of a person's perceived race. The whole genetic thing has been a bogus explanation for a long time, going back over 100 years. And when we looked at that in some studies using the Illinois population, we found that, in fact, some Black babies have the same pattern of preterm birth and low birth weight that we see among white babies. And who are they? It turns out they're babies whose mothers have immigrated to Illinois from West Africa. In other words, 100% African genetically, as opposed to maybe 75% for African Americans. And yet they have much better birth outcomes. So the genetic theory is basically pretty much discarded. The socioeconomic theory, that is looking for common factors of Black and white that apply more to Blacks, contributes, but it doesn't explain everything. And that leaves us with the specifics, specific risks for minority women who are exposed to the discrimination of a society which is unfair on the basis of race. I mean, to use it, the most straightforward term, structural racism, would be the best explanation.
My guest, sir, Dr. Richard David, you just heard him. He's a professor of pediatrics at UIC, former director of the neonatal intensive care unit at Stroger Hospital in Chicago. Janine Hill is also on the line with us. She also is at UIC Chicago, where she teaches in the School of Public Health, former director of the Illinois Maternal and Child Health Coalition. Janine, to Dr. David's point about structural racism, I think that's a big thing that is might be harder for people to understand how this affects mothers and babies. And in your classes, you talk about someone named Shalon Irving. Can you tell us about her and what how that case may help us understand this a little bit more?
Sure. I'm glad to talk about this case because I think it illustrates many of the systems-level failures that that Black women go through as they access and interact with the healthcare system. So Shalon Irving, there was a series done by Nina Martin at ProPublica, and Shalon Irving was 36 in 2017 and an epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. She became pregnant in mid-2016 with her first child and really excited about being a mom. And, you know, the short version of the story is that 3 weeks after she delivered her child, she collapsed and died from complications of high blood pressure. Mm. And so, she absolutely had a number of risk factors that we would say made her a high-risk pregnancy. And she's a healthcare person. She works at the preeminent healthcare institution in our country and so knew everything. She has two master's degrees and a PhD and was going back to the doctor and had really troubling signs of edema. Her legs were swelling, and she was going back and forth to the doctor. They never readmitted her again after she delivered, and she dropped dead at 36.
Hmm. And Dr. David, to that point, I wonder when we think about structural racism in that case in particular, how much of that story, of Shalon's story, we think is something similar to that is happening not just throughout Illinois, but the country.
I think that sort of story probably plays out daily throughout the country. Hopefully not with quite as dramatic and catastrophic outcomes, but similar sorts of things. It's it's very, very common when you interview African-American patients, including women, but also, you know, adult male heart disease patients or whatever, it's very common to hear from them that their healthcare providers don't take their complaints as seriously as they think they should be taken. And this is not just a perception of the patients. There are now is a very extensive literature documenting that responses by physicians vary not just with the symptoms, signs, and data, but with the race and social class of the patient. It's unfortunate, but it's part of the reality of the society we live in. I think it has a significant contributing factor to the outcomes we're talking about. Structural racism is not just on an interpersonal level. It's also, it plays out at the level, for example, of having employment. The statistics from Chicago, for example, show that black men in their early 20s had something like a 47% unemployment rate when these statistics were collected a couple of years ago. Well, that's a massively high number and has to have an impact. These are young men, you know, at the age where childbearing and having families is expected to be the norm, and yet half of them have no way of supporting a family. This is not because people don't look for jobs. It's because the jobs are not given out in an equitable manner, and there are not sufficient jobs for everyone.
Janine, as we think about how to work against this and change this, what kind of things do you teach your students in public health in terms of solutions for how to make this better?
Sure. So we went over Shalon's. I teach a maternal and child health delivery systems class in the spring semester at the School of Public Health, and we do systems mapping, and so we went over Shalon's case and thought about, like, really how did the system fail, and I think there are some thoughts about that, and I think Dr. David already talked about many of them, which are, you know, African-American women, in some ways, regardless of educational status, insurance status, or socioeconomic status, are known in many studies to receive lower quality health care. They are frequently told, as Dr. David said, that their pain is not as bad as they think it is. They frequently report that people and healthcare providers are not taking their pain seriously. I think Shalon's case gives us really pause about, we focus so much about the prenatal care setting, and rightfully so. You want to reduce risk factors while the infant is in utero, but we kind of let moms fall off in the postpartum care scenario with sometimes disastrous consequences like Shalon's untimely death. So we really do need to think about, you know, some people call it the fourth trimester, and thinking about that postpartum care and how do we kind of step up our game in terms of providing adequate and quality postpartum care so that you don't have that situation. I think there's a lot more research that needs to be done to think about, like, how women come into the health status of women both prior to and during pregnancy, and thinking about our reproductive trajectories as part of a life course, thinking about how we collect data on maternal mortality and infant mortality by race and ethnicity. And, I mean, those are short-term solutions, right? And Dr. David so rightfully has put this in the context of structural racism and larger, bigger, hairier societal issues that we have to face, like you know, having to work twice as hard for, you know, not as much a return, and having an income and a great job, but not wealth. So I've been working on my dissertation research, and I've interviewed women, middle-class women, both white and black women, who had just had a baby in the past 6 months, and try to get a sense of their stressors. And from the black women, you hear things like, I'm taking care of my family members. I'm the one that made it. I'm the one that has a good education. So I'm supporting my mom and my sister and my sister's kids.
There's
I'm
so
really
many right
about in you know, financial and other types of things. So I think we really do have to think about social determinants of health.
So many issues here. Thank you for bringing some of them to light for us, Janine Hill, Dr. Richard David, both from UIC, on this issue of maternal and infant health among the African American community. Both of you, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for having us.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're looking for something fun and important to add to your calendar this weekend, you should know Southern Illinois is having its first ever Pride Festival. From Friday through Sunday, Carbondale's LGBT community will celebrate diversity inclusion with a walk, music, drag performances, food, bingo, and more. And proceeds go to benefit the Rainbow Cafe, which is a drop-in youth center that serves gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth in Southern Illinois. Joining me to talk about getting this festival off the ground is one of the organizers, Tara Bell Janowick. She's also on the board of Rainbow Cafe and on the line from Heron, Illinois, just outside Carbondale. Hi, Tara. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. How long have you been planning this?
Oh, my goodness. We started discussing plans for this festival in October of last year, and we really got busy getting everything worked out probably in January.
And why did you want to be involved with this?
Well, we felt this was really important for our area. Every year, the Church of the Good Shepherd hosts a Pride picnic in September, which is awesome. That's more localized and more focused on the Carbondale community and more of a family picnic feel, which is really great. The Reverend of the Carbondale Unitarian Fellowship had suggested that we organize something that was a little bit more visible to actually occur during June, during Pride Month, to celebrate Stonewall. And we felt that doing a walk where we went through downtown Carbondale up to the pavilion and having a festival for all of Southern Illinois would be really important in order to raise visibility and awareness of our community, not only in Carbondale, but across the Southern Illinois region. So many of our small towns and our schools and our GSAs and our LGBTQ folk are really kind of isolated in the smaller regions down here. And having a community festival which brought everyone together was really important for us.
And who have you been partnering with to bring this together?
One of my committee members, who is also the vice chair of the Rainbow Cafe board, is Chip Lowry, and he's been crucial in helping to organize everything with me. The Carbondale First Christian Church, which is the Disciples of Christ, has been an amazing organization helping to plan. Of course, the Carbondale Unitarian Fellowship and the Church of the Good Shepherd are organizations that have jumped in and helped out a lot. The Varsity Center in Carbondale has been wonderful in helping to organize everything. And the drag community, the entertainers here in Southern Illinois, have jumped right on board and have been incredibly helpful with getting everything together for us.
So it sounds like mostly local churches have been really instrumental in helping lead this effort in the Carbondale area.
They absolutely have, yes. Carbondale has three LGBTQ affirming churches, the ones that I've just mentioned, and they have been very helpful and very instrumental in putting the process together for us.
So what's the plan for the weekend? There's lots of things going on.
Oh my gosh, yes. Starting tomorrow night at the Varsity Center, there's a welcome reception, and that of course is hosted by those three affirming churches, the Carbondale Unitarian Fellowship, First Christian Church, and the Church of the Good Shepherd. And that reception not only kicks off the Pride Festival, but also features the artwork of artist Sean Vincelette, who is an LGBTQ artist who is based in Atlanta, but was born and raised in Marion, Illinois. And he does an amazing exhibit. It's called the, let me see here. It is the Iconic Personality Series. After that reception, starting at 8 p.m., the Varsity is showing the movie Milk, which is the story of Harvey Milk. And that is an incredible film to show at this point in time. You know, Illinois is working towards passing the Inclusive Curriculum Act that helps to recognize LGBTQ history figures in our curriculum in our schools. And using a film such as that to kick off Pride that recognizes an iconic figure is really important for us. At 10:30 that night at the Varsity, we're going to have a showing of the movie The Birdcage, so something fun to follow up the serious kind of historical thing. Moving into Saturday, we start our Pride Walk. It is not a full parade. It is a walk. We'll be on the sidewalks with signs and all that good stuff. That starts at the Carbondale Gaia House at 11 a.m. We walk from the Carbondale Gaia House to the Town Square Pavilion, where we'll have our festival from noon until 4 p.m. The festival will feature the living legend Lance Dubois as our mistress of ceremonies. We have performances by Heather Hammers, Laura King Neville, Improv by Noble and Roman.
We so it sounds like you've got so many different events that you have planned. It sounds like lots of things that are planned for the weekend. Tara, can I ask, as someone who was born and raised in Southern Illinois, how, if you feel like things have changed in that part of the state in terms of being a welcoming place to the LGBT community?
Very much so, yes. I graduated high school in 1990, and I'm a bisexual woman. My son is transgender, and I know when I was in high school, this was something that everybody struggled with. Very few people came out. It was not something that was embraced or welcomed. Pretty much everybody stayed in the closet. As I have grown up, matured, and aged, we've seen a lot more acceptance. We have a lot of GSAs, Gay Straight Alliances, popping up at our local high schools in the area. The Rainbow Cafe has been a great place to show support to LGBTQ youth. It's just something that is a lot more open and accepting. At the same time, there are still a lot of areas that folks just can't come out. Still a lot of prejudice and discrimination in a lot of the smaller areas, which is why a festival of this to raise awareness and education is so important.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the Rainbow Cafe?
Absolutely, yes. The Rainbow Cafe is in its 18th year of existence. It started in September of 2000. And we are an LGBTQ plus youth center. We're open on Friday nights from 6 to 10 p.m. We also have programming on Saturday afternoons once a month. That's called our Youth Empowerment Saturdays. We host Unconditional, which is a parent and family support group that meets once a month. And we also host a group called Transitions, and that is for trans youth and young adults ages 16 to 21.
What's it like for you to be able to be planning this and share this with your son this weekend?
This has been pretty exciting. My son is not quite as visible in the community as some other youth, struggling with, you know, issues of coming out and all that good stuff. However, working on something like this to just show that support and show the awareness has been a really good experience, you know, for him as well as for myself.
And is your hope, do you have a sense of how many folks you think will turn out this weekend? Or for people who aren't in Southern Illinois, what do you want them to know?
Right. We're looking at probably between 200 and 500 people, which is really exciting. I want everyone to know that, you know, Carbondale is a small town. This is like a block party. This is something that is going to be amazing for everyone here. It's not going to be as flashy or as, you know, professionalized, I guess we'd put it, as maybe something that you'd see in St. Louis or Chicago. But at the same time, we hope that this is the seed of a plant that grows and flourishes year after year, and that this will become more established and bigger and better in years to come. And everything that we've got planned over the course of the weekend should serve all different audiences, different genres, different things that people are interested in, from art shows to church services.
Thanks for joining us. It's Tara Bell Janowick, one of the organizers of the planning committee for the first ever Southern Illinois Pride Festival that's going to be taking place this weekend. Thank you for being with us, Tara.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Speaking of civil rights, there was also a historic vote by the Illinois House to pass the Equal Rights Amendment last night.
A no vote is a vote against the women of America.
Dallas Paul was pro-life, and the sponsor and his allies on this have twisted her language into a mechanism for abortion, something that Ms. Paul never would have stood for.
The Equal Rights Amendment will also be a very effective tool for women of color when you're talking about violence against women, when you're talking about sexual harassment, when you're talking about rape. The women of color are the most affected.
It would take away the 18-year-old girl's right to be exempt from the military draft. It would take away the right of the wife to be supported by her husband, which was then... Those things are a matter of laws, and what the Equal Rights Amendment would do is to make all the laws sex neutral.
Women who present to the world like me have been asking for centuries, ain't I a woman? And we continue to hear a resounding no to that question almost every day.
Those are the voices of Democratic Representative Lou Lang of Skokie, instrumental in this ERA movement, Republican Representative Peter Green of Lombard, Carol Robles Roman, who helped lead the ERA coalition, ERA opponent Phyllis Schlafly, and ending with Rockford Representative Leticia Wallace. It was a very close vote, but yesterday, Illinois became the 37th state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. We started the hour following all of this action in the state house. Let's end with Senate President John Cullerton, a Chicago Democrat who's on the line from Springfield. Senator Cullerton, welcome back to the 21st.
Yes, happy to be here.
I want to ask you about the ERA in a minute, but let me start with the budget process. This last budget-making process was obviously very different in tone, in timing, in the end result. What do you think made the difference this year to a compromise deal?
Well, the difference this year was primarily because of what we did last year. So last year we were able to, over the objection of the governor and the Republicans, for most of them, to pass the revenue and a whole bunch of cuts and reforms in the budget to get a budget last year. And of course, as a result of that, we were much closer this year when we started our negotiations. And as a result, we ended up with in effect, I think that it's an election year, probably played a role. No sense in staying here all summer in a dysfunctional state when you're running for a governor. So as a result, the governor has indicated he's going to sign off. The budget yesterday, the vote was only two no votes. And for me, the education, a second year in a row, was a major priority. Last year, we passed not only a $350 million increase, but more importantly, a huge reform in the way we distribute the money. And we're doubling down on that again this year with another $350 million increase.
Senator Cullerton, I'm sorry, I just want to clarify something you said. Is it clear, did you say that you have heard from Governor Rauner that if the bill passes the House, he will be signing it?
No. Our negotiations took place, most of the negotiations took place without the governor in the room. And so we only had the representations of the Republican leaders who indicated that they were negotiating on behalf of the governor and that they signed off on it. So we're assuming that the governor would sign off on the bill.
That said, what did you have to give up to make this a bipartisan compromise?
Well, actually, when you have an agreement, you have to listen to the other side. You can't get 100% of what you want. So I wouldn't focus on what we had to give up. I'd rather focus on the things that we changed from what the governor's introduced budget was. So we didn't dump a bunch of state pension costs on the local schools, which would have actually had the effect of cutting education money. We didn't go along with that. The governor had proposed that. And so that's a major, major effort. In addition, of course, we found through very cooperative references to pension savings with constitutional pension reforms, we were able to raise enough money so that we had the ability to even give more money for our universities, which had been cut by 10% in the previous years, and to establish a $50 million scholarship fund to help keep our kids in the schools. So this is a budget that I think we should be very proud of. And the fact that it's bipartisan is a good sign of stability, and that's what the most important thing we need to do after three really tough years.
Senator Cullerton, I know you have to run for a vote. Just want to ask you quickly about the Equal Rights Amendment being approved by the House with a vote to spare. I know you all in the Senate voted in support of this last month. 36 years since the ERA was put forward for ratification to the U.S. Constitution. Your thoughts on the vote?
Well, you know what? I can tell you that I'm the only one here who's voted for the ERA in both the House and in the Senate. So obviously I'm supportive of it, and I think it's more than symbolic. I hope it becomes one more state and hope it becomes the law
Senate
of the land.
Yeah, thank you for your time, Senate President John Cullerton. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be wrapping up the week talking about the summer travel season with NPR's Midwest correspondent David Shaper. He's going to be giving us some tips and updates on what's going on at O'Hare Midway and train and car travel as well. So stay tuned for that tomorrow on the program. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Last night, we were tweeting out results of the budget and ERA negotiations. You can also find us on Facebook, send us a message, post comments or questions you'd like us to ask on air. All you have to remember for all of these things is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Ramin Lin, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.